Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everybody. It's the Ron Brooks Show, broadcasting today from London, the UK, where at kind of the getting close to the end of this trip. This is my seventh country, one more country to go, and then back to the U.S., actually to Chicago in the U.S. I'm not even heading home over the weekend for some more events over there, and then finally back home. So I think in total, this trip will be, 18, 19, 20 events, something like that. So I think I spend the first part of the show talking a little bit about my impressions of Europe. Last time we talked, I was in Greece. Since then, I have been to Moscow. I've been to Tbilisi, Kiev, Vilnius, and now London. So, lots happened in the last week. A lot of cool stuff. A lot of good talks. A lot of good meetings. A lot of amazing people. Really, really is interesting. I mean, every time I come back from one of these trips, I'm motivated and excited. And this trip is no different. Particularly about the prospects in East Europe. So let me just say, Gao. I mean, an amazing city, beautiful city. I was in the center of Moscow. My hotel was literally across the street from Red Square. It's a hotel that Lenin, I guess, used to stay at. So I felt really, really had to take several showers a day. The Kremlin, all of that. It's clean. It's pristine. The shopping around it, the restaurants, everything is really clean. It's really nice. I guess you can't really tell from the traffic jams and all the activity in Moscow that they're going through a massive economic contraction, and they're really, 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 really in trouble economically. So, I didn't really like Moscow. I mean, there's something about Russia that I guess I don't like. I don't know the culture well enough to comment like Ayn Rand did. Obviously, she didn't like the Russian culture, but there were great people there. So I did do a talk, a small group, in a basement somewhere. I felt very counter-revolutionary in Russia, which was kind of fun, and it was some great people there. People listening to the show and people who follow what we do at the Institute and what I do and. And it's kind of exciting to have, to have a following in Moscow. So good group of kind of libertarians / objectivists / free markets, classical liberals. Unfortunately, a small group, but everybody tells me that Ayn Rand is selling amazingly well in Russia. She's very popular. I met a number of business people and just young people. A friend of mine organized an event at a coffee shop, and I got to just meet 10 young people. Some of them have read Ayn Rand, Atlas Shrugged in particular. Almost everybody had heard of Ayn Rand. So she has real visibility, I think, right now in Russia, which is great. I mean, can you imagine what she would think of the fact that she was popular, followed, that people were intrigued by her in Russia, that between 2010 and 2013, Ayn Rand sold over 100,000 books in Russia? I mean, that is pretty amazing. So I think Ayn Rand would be inspired. Ayn Rand would be interested. So So Russia, I met with a lot of people, spent time with people. It was really interesting. A lot of people who want free markets, a lot of people who are frustrated with the existing system in Russia. And it struck me as there were some entrepreneurial people. I guess Moscow has this imperial look to it, maybe because I was, staying right across the street from the Kremlin. That'll do it to you. I think I enjoyed St. Petersburg more. St. Petersburg had a much, much more beautiful, much more 19th century sense to it. The other thing you get is these Soviet buildings. Oh, my God. I saw this everywhere in Romania, in Kiev, in Moscow, even in Tbilisi. You see these Soviet-era ugly, ugly monstrosities in gray and boxy and just ugly. No sense of aesthetics at all, and a sense of this real sense of egalitarianism, but everybody has to be the same and poor. Although in Moscow, they showed me one building, this massive building, just huge. And it's I guess, an apartment complex. And supposedly that was where all the communist officials actually lived. And those all luxury apartments, massive, big, and so on. So that was Moscow. I'm happy to, if you've guys got questions about any of my travels, anything I say, or about the state of the world, let me get to my description of Europe before we get to the state of the world. But just generally, if you have any questions, it's 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075, particularly if you have specific questions about this trip for now, and then we'll go on from there. All right, so from Moscow, I flew to Tbilisi in Georgia. And, first, Tbilisi is a pretty, pretty city. It's in kind of in the hills. It's surrounded by hills. It's kind of up and down valleys. So the geography is pretty. Parts of it are pretty ugly. Those parts that look more Soviet. And then the old town is kind of really nice. There's a river that runs through it. There's a lot of old churches. I mean, Georgia goes back. I mean, if you know where Georgia is, and I know you Americans, most of you are completely ignorant of geography. But you should look Georgia up, and it's kind of, it's between Europe and Asia, but it has really ancient roots. Supposedly some of the apostles made it up there. It became Christian. Christians had influence there relatively early on. It's been conquered by the Muslims. It's been conquered by Christians. It's been conquered by everybody. And of course, it was under Soviet occupation for a long time. And what's fascinating, what's truly fascinating, first of all, the Georgians are all really nice people. I mean, everybody I met was incredibly nice. Supposedly, it's a very safe place. It's a great place to do business. I stayed in a nice hotel. And everything was really nice. And then a lot of traffic as well. And I spent some time with some bankers, some senior bankers, the top executives of the two largest banks in Georgia. I had two separate meetings with them. And one of them is a huge Ayn Rand fan. He actually committed over dinner. He committed to funding the translation of Atlas Shrugged into Georgian. So I'm excited about that because Georgian is one of the few languages where Atlas Shrugged does not be translated. And some of that makes sense because it's an expensive project and there are only 3 million Georgians in Georgia. And it's hard to make money when you have such a small population, like that. What is interesting about Georgia is how free markets it has been over the last 10, 15 years. Now, on and off, different governments have had different policies. But in general, it has had some prime ministers who have been unbelievably free market, more free market than anybody I know in the last 100 years. So they have truly, in many respects, freed up the economy. There was a period there was a period a few years ago where for 9 years there were no food inspectors in Georgia. They abandoned food inspection. They said the market can take care of this. There were no building inspectors. There were no OSHA, safety and employment inspectors. And of course, as a consequence of that, everybody died because they all got food poisoning and they all died. Well, no, of course, what really happened is nothing. Everything's fine. And to this day, there's no inspectors of workplaces, no regulation of workplaces. very little employment law. So more free market reforms, radical free market reforms, I'd say, than any other place I know. Something that just happened in Georgia is they've done away with the corporate income tax. Corporate income tax in Georgia is zero. You only pay taxes on what you get out of the corporation. There's dividends, I guess interest, maybe capital gains. But I don't know if they tax capital gains. But that's pretty amazing. A zero corporate income tax. In the United States, we're talking about, you know, maybe lowering it down a little bit. I think in the end of the day, Hillary will lower the corporate income tax a little bit. Corporate income tax, by the way, is one of the sneakiest taxes in the world because it's a tax. It's a consumption tax that's hidden. You don't know you're paying it, but you pay it every day in a higher prices of good because of the corporate income tax. And employees, actually, there's a bunch of studies that show that when you do away with the corporate income tax, wages go up. That is part of the tax is an employment tax. So corporate income tax, this evil corporations pay, oh my God, is actually a tax that's passed on to both employees in the form of lower wages and to customers, consumers, in the form of higher prices. So one of the simplest things one could do just to bring sanity to one's economy is to lower the corporate income tax to zero. Zero is the only rational corporate income tax rate. And I tell this to people, and it can't sink in because most people, you know, corporations, they make a lot of money. We've got to tax it. Well, you know, you're not taxing it. You're taxing yourself. You're taxing, you know, if you work for a corporation or if you buy stuff from a corporation, which everybody does, you're basically taxing yourself. It's almost like tariffs, right? Oh, let's tax those Chinese for selling us stuff. No, you know, tariffs are a tax on consumption. It's a tax on you. Right. So Georgia, I think Georgia and Estonia are the only two countries in the world that have a zero corporate income tax. And actually the tax system in Estonia, in Georgia, has been modeled after the Estonian model. Estonia has done very well. Anyway, I get to Estonia. I've got some meetings. I really don't have time to walk around or anything. And then I go over to give a talk, and the place is packed. I have over 200 people at this talk, mostly students, but some faculty members. I had a woman sitting in the front row who's a marketing professor, and she was like, "Atlas Shrugged, this is my favorite book. This is so cool that you're here. You know, I love Ayn Rand." And there were a number of people, I mean, just an amazing number of people who told me that. Just stunning. So I spoke at this university. I think it was the University of Georgia. And there's a professor who teaches there, but he really runs a local Georgian think tank, free market think tank. And he's read all of Ayn Rand, and he considers himself a classical liberal, and he's read everything. And he's a huge Ayn Rand fan. He's not an objectivist, but a huge Ayn Rand fan. And, you know, it's just fascinating. Here you are in the middle of, I don't know, in the middle of nowhere, right? In this country that's kind of Asia and kind of Europe and stuck in the middle and on the border with a number of, you know, Azerbaijan is on this border, which is a Muslim country, but it's really on the precipice of the entire Muslim world right there. And I had Muslim students in the audience. I had students from Kurdistan. I had students from Azerbaijan. I had students from all over the Caucasus, all over that part of the world. And the response was really, really, really positive. I mean, it was really fantastic. And great Q&A. Lots of good questions. I think it was all taped, so I'm assuming it'll all be up on YouTube at some point. So I encourage you to listen. And, you know, even though Azerbaijan, even though it's a secular country, it's a Muslim country. It's people who live there are Muslim. You know, there's so many people in objectivism, around objectivism, that just hate Islam with such a passion, you know, and cannot separate out the religion from the radicals, the jihadis. Now, you know, all religion is an enemy of objectivism. I'll kind of get to that in the second half of the show today. But the enemy is not, I've said this many times, and I'm sure a lot of people are going to get pissed off at this. The enemy is not Islam. Azerbaijan, Kurdistan, other places where people are Muslim, but are not Islamists, not jihadis, and Azerbaijan, for example, it's a secular country, in spite of being a majority Muslim country. Just like Georgia is a secular country, in spite of being majority Orthodox, Christian Orthodox. So it was fascinating. It was fascinating to speak in front of an audience like that, talk about capitalism, talk about freedom, talk about morality, talked a lot about self-interest versus altruism, talked about the dangers of religion, and religion leads to altruism, and the dangers of mysticism. And it was great. I mean, it was open. There was the free speech. There was no issues being shouted down. There was no leftist demonstrating outside. And where in the United States do you get 200 students coming to hear a talk on the morality of capitalism? I mean, it's very unusual and really, quite inspiring. So I really enjoyed that talk. And then what was fascinating is the next day I had a morning talk or early afternoon talk at another university called Free University, and I was told this is the best university in Georgia. And they insisted that I come early so that I get a tour of the university and I get to meet the provost and, it turns out, meet the owner of the university. So this is a private university, as most of the universities in Georgia are now. That's one of the things these governments have done. They've privatized the universities. So I go to this university and the first thing that they start talking about is that the founder of this university was an adamant, radical free market guy, that he was a huge believer in free markets and capitalism, that one of the reasons he bought the university was to be able to perpetuate these ideas, that he was passionate, that while supposedly he'd never admitted to reading Ayn Rand, he often kind of used references that were obviously from Ayn Rand. So I don't know why he didn't want to admit to reading her, but he did. It's clear that he did. The people who work there, there was a vice dean that I went into an office and she's got pictures of Ayn Rand on the wall. I met the provost, right, the head of academic affairs at the university, and he comes and he says, "Oh, I read Ayn Rand years ago. I love Atlas Shrugged. You know, these are important ideas. We have to talk about them. This is so crucial in our world." It was fantastic. It's fantastic. You never find this in America. It just doesn't exist. Private university, considered the best university in Georgia. And, everybody is a huge Ayn Rand fan. And then I met the owner. And the owner is the daughter of this guy who founded the university. She's 25 years old. She's 25 years old, and she's inherited a huge amount of money, including she's inherited this university. Now, the university is technically owned by a nonprofit, but she is the sole controller of this nonprofit. So she owns it. And she's like, she's a huge Ayn Rand fan. She loves Atlas Shrugged. She loves Ayn Rand. This is great. She wants to work with us. How can we work with the Ayn Rand Institute? How can we do more? How can we get more of Ayn Rand's ideas into the curriculum? I'm speechless. This is amazing. The revolution, my friends, might not, and I've said this on shows before, might not happen in the United States. It might happen in Georgia or Colombia or Ukraine or Brazil or somewhere else, because there is so much more, in a sense, excitement about Ayn Rand. There's so much more passion about Ayn Rand in those countries than there is, I think, today in the United States. So it's really, really, interesting. I mean, I was completely blown away because I did not know. I did not know. I did not know that to expect this in Georgia. I knew Georgia was a free marketplace. I didn't realize how much. I didn't realize to what extent. Now, one of the people told me that in the Georgian election, there was an election recently, every single party competed, even the socialists, all of them competed on who would lower taxes the most. Who would lower taxes the most? That was the competition. I mean, blows your mind. Where in the West do we have political regimes, political parties who are competing to lower taxes? Now, still too many people work for the government in Georgia. Government spending is way too high still. So there are real problems, and there are still real problems. And But it's inspiring. It really is inspiring. I have to tell Iran in the chat, please don't write in these huge letters. It's distracting. I'm going to Mongolia next year. Just you know, he wants me to go to Mongolia. I'm going to Mongolia next year. I've already got it all planned out. I've been invited, and I'm going, and I'm doing a speaking tour there, and they're translating my book into Mongolian. But it's too distracting when you do this. All right. That was Tbilisi. So I spent one night in Tbilisi, two events, lots of meetings, great food, by the way. The other thing is the food is fantastic. Oh, my God. A really, really interesting, flavorful food in Georgia. So that's thumbs up to the Georgians on that. So I'm going back to Georgia. There's no question. I'm inspired. Then on top of that, then from Tbilisi, I flew to Kiev, and I flew to Kiev like in the evening, and then I basically got an Uber in Kiev, and Uber in Kiev works great, by the way. And I went to see a play. I went to see the final few minutes of a play. There was a performance of Night of January the 16th by Ayn Rand in Kiev in Ukrainian. pretty amazing. And they asked me, the people who organized it, a couple, this woman who directed it and produced it, asked me to come and say a few words after the play. So I got to stand up in front of this audience, and we had a young woman who was a translator. And I spoke about Night of January 16th and took questions from the audience, and the audience was really engaged. And almost everybody in the audience, a number of the people in the audience had read Atlas Shrugged. Atlas Shrugged is in Ukrainian in three volumes. It's been the third volume came out last year. And supposedly when it came out, it was a bestseller, instant bestseller in Ukraine. Fountainhead is out now. I saw the book, and so it is out, and it's striking. Kiev is an interesting city. It's got a combination of 19th century architecture and early 20th century. Some modern buildings, not many, but a few modern buildings, and then the whole Soviet era where they just ghastly buildings. You can always tell a Soviet era building very, very easily. Anyway, I did the play, and the next morning, I can't remember what I did, but basically that afternoon I flew to Vilnius. And if you're getting tired just listening to this, imagine how I feel. Flew to Vilnius in Lithuania and spoke to a small group of Students for Liberty, but it was fun. They were motivated kids, great questions. I also had as a speaker with me the head of the Free Market Institute in Lithuania that are doing really good work and really important work to promote free markets. But the students, they were just so cute and so enthusiastic and so nice that it really is just fantastic to meet people all over the world who value liberty, who value freedom. And you know, some of them know Ayn Rand and many of them don't, but that's our job is to get them to get to know Ayn Rand and really change their lives. They think that some of these libertarian ideas are going to change their lives. The real change in their lives is Ayn Rand. I flew then back to Kiev, right? And I was invited, I thought, to give a talk at the leading business school in Kiev on a Friday afternoon. This is the day before yesterday. And we had been contacted by the business school to have me give this talk. So I thought, you know, this is exciting, and they're sponsoring it. So, the business school is a formal talk. It's Friday afternoon, which was a little bit weird for a talk. But anyway, this is a business school I'd spoken at before. I'd basically come in and did like an open Q&A with one of the professors. You can find the video of that on YouTube. It's if you look, I guess you're on Book Kiev Business School, something like that. You can probably find a wonderful thing, wonderful time. We got great questions. It was just a kind of Q&A, very relaxed. We were sitting on a sofa. It was great. Anyway, I show up at the business school and I say, you know, here I am for the talk. And they go, oh, great, great. Class is about to begin. And I go, what are you talking about? And they say, oh, you're teaching a class. I said, what do you mean I'm teaching a class? I thought I was giving a talk. I said, oh, no. You're teaching an executive MBA class for 3 hours now. That's at 3:30 in the afternoon. They're telling me I am about to teach a 3-hour class out of nowhere. I was not ready. supposedly they had told us this, but here I was, went into an executive MBA class. So these all executives in Ukraine, you know, middle-aged men and women, experienced senior positions, CEOs, presidents of companies and all of this. And I give them a 3-hour class on basically the morality of capitalism, some inequality, some ethics in there. We talked about capitalism, the history of capitalism, antitrust. I mean, 3 hours, you can cover a lot of stuff. So it was a blast. It was very cool. And you know, I think there was some miscommunication between my people and their people and everything. But it was great. I'm not complaining. Oh, and then what happened, right? So the students in preparation for this class were required to read Atlas Shrugged. So imagine that in an executive MBA program at the best MBA school in Ukraine, the students are required to read Atlas Shrugged. I mean, that's just pretty amazing. And yes, I did the whole 3 hours off the top of my head, but you know, that's what I get the big bucks for. So in the break, this guy comes up to me and says, look, I'm the vice dean for foreign relations. And look, you have to understand, this business school was the founding principles of this business school are basically consistent with Atlas Shrugged. He says, I've read Atlas Shrugged. I've read Atlas Shrugged in English. And I love Atlas Shrugged. And I think every student in the school is required to read Atlas Shrugged. It's really, really important to us. And we'd love to work with the Ironman Institute to bring these ideas deeper into our curriculum and deeper into what we do. And it's like we talked about me maybe teaching some classes by Skype. We talked about, well, we're going to send them a whole library of books for their library so they can have all of Ayn Rand's books and all the other books. I mean, what the hell? In Ukraine, just like in Georgia, but in Ukraine, the leading business school in the entire country is requiring students to read Atlas Shrugged. They have Atlas Shrugged and the Fountainhead nicely displayed in the welcome area. Truly is stunning. It leaves me somewhat speechless. So, you know, maybe the Ayn Rand Institute should move to like Kiev or Tbilisi or something else. So that's kind of Friday afternoon. So I teach a class for 3 hours. And I can't even remember what I did after that because I definitely did something after that. I know. It doesn't matter. Okay, I was on the phone for another 3 hours after that institute business. But then Saturday, yesterday. That's right, yesterday. Yesterday, I spoke at the Students for Liberty, European Students for Liberty Regional Conference in Kiev. And it's a whole day event, and they have multiple speakers all day. And when I spoke, there were over 400 students in the audience, 400 people in the audience. And it was a mixture. There's some libertarians or some people who love objectivism, Ayn Rand, and then there were some lefties or centrists or whatever. So I spoke for about half an hour and did a half an hour Q&A. And it was terrific. It was, again, people excited and motivated. And then when I finished speaking, you know, a bunch of people jumped on me and they wanted to talk and they wanted to ask me more questions. And then the other thing that happened to me in Kiev, which is happening more and more around the world and happened to me in London this afternoon as well, is somebody came up to me out of nowhere and said, oh my God, it's Yaron Brook. I saw you and Dave Rubin. That was the best interview ever. That interview I did with Dave Rubin has had more impact on more people than anything I've ever done. It's stunning. It is so amazing, and it's global. It's in some ways happening more outside the United States than inside the United States. So if you haven't watched my interview with Dave Rubin, just go to YouTube and put my name and Dave Rubin, R-U-B-I-N, and you can see it. It's a great interview, and it's inspired many, many people. And it's for me, it's been really, really, really exciting. So that was a blast. So I spoke to 400 people, and then constantly students would come up to me and talk. And they were passionate. And my talk in Kiev, it'll go up online. My talk in Kiev was basically, don't give up. You got to fight. And here's how you fight. And I told them what to do in order to fight. So a little bit like what you can do, or what one can do, which is the talk I gave at OCON that you can, again, find on YouTube. But it was... you know, it was terrific. The books were there in Kiev. You know, the books were on display. I think people are teaching them. And, you know, things, all that went really, really well. I then flew late last night from Kiev to London. And today in London, I participate in something called the Battle of Ideas. This is a big event with thousands of people, or maybe more accurately, probably 1,500 to 2,000 people. You get about 50 to 100, maybe 150 people in any given event. Lots of things going on in parallel. It's mainly kind of intellectual leftists up in the audience, or semi-intellectual leftists. It's run by, you know, left-leaning people who love free speech and respect debate and respect ideas. And that was, which was, and they're really terrific people. And this is my second time at the Battle of Ideas. I did three panels. Okay. Three panels. Let me tell you about these panels. Then I'll tell you about what's due for me the rest of the week. And then we'll shift to maybe some other topics. And by the way, if you call in with questions, it'll make my life easier because I'm exhausted. It is 9 o'clock, 9 p.m. here. I spoke yesterday in Kiev, the day before 3 hours in Kiev. Today I did three different events at the Battle of Ideas in London, so a little tired. So recommend. So in other words, I'm exhausted, and so call and ask me questions because that makes my life easier. I will say, somebody says here, when will other ARI people be interviewed by Dave Rubin? They will be. You can expect Don Watkins to be interviewed probably in December, and maybe Steve Simpson in January, February. And my hope is, and my expectation is, that I will be interviewed again by Dave Rubin sometime early next year. We'll see. Working on it. But Dave is in great demand. There are a lot of people who would like to be interviewed by him, and he's got a whole plan of who he wants to interview. But I'm hoping he interviews me again and other people from the Institute. I'm sure he will. So three events today were kind of interesting. First event was, I think it's the first time I've ever actually in front of an audience spoken about this issue, and it's drug legalization. So the whole thing was about, should we declare a truce in the war on drugs? And of course, my comment was we should pull out the white flag, because this is a war. If you can have a war against an inanimate object, I don't think you can have a war against an inanimate object. But clearly we have lost, or whoever is waging this war has lost. So why a truce? You just declare surrender and do away with it. And we talked about, so I tried to give them all individual rights case. And really, the individual rights, not so much. I care less, I have to say, about the drug users. I care much more about the police, about the court system, about the bystanders who get shot, by the collateral damage that is caused by the enormous violence in Latin America, the enormous violence in the United States, the fact that we have hundreds of thousands of young men and some women incarcerated in American prisons for what? For smoking pot or for possession of cocaine. Who cares? So it's, you know, it's pretty scary, the whole idea of war drugs. I think that the police have also militarized to a large extent because of the war drugs. That's what he calls it. And, that's what's caused, I think, the militarization. So the war on drugs is a disaster. So I talked about that, other people, but what's interesting is everybody in the panel and most of the audience were for legalizing drugs. And now one of the guys on the panels was very much romanticizing drugs as a wonderful thing. You know, I had a fight back on some of those things, but it was interesting. Anyway, so I did that, and that was kind of fun. And maybe we'll do a whole show someday on drugs, using drugs, legalizing drugs, what drugs mean, why do them, why not do them, whatever. After that panel, I did a panel on inequality, which became very heated, both in terms of the audience disagreeing with me and the other panelists disagreeing with me quite violently, and on taxes and inequality. And then the third panel was a panel on utopian thinking. I still don't know what exactly that means, but it was about basically whether we should have ideals or not, and whether we should be optimistic or pessimistic about the future. You know, it was a difficult panel, but you know what was interesting? This is what was interesting, that in the two panels, the inequality and utopian thinking, I found, and it really stunned me, I have to say, is that on these panels, on both panels, there were leftists who were decent. In this sense, they were pro-growth, pro-prosperity, anti-environmentalism leftists. Now, did you know that such people existed? I thought they all died in the 60s. I thought they were long gone. This is like the old left, the left that believes in progress and reason and science, the left that believes that man should adapt nature to suit his means. I mean, there are no leftists like that in the United States that I know of. So I was positively surprised by the existence of a semi-rational, economically ignorant and stupid left, but nonetheless a left that does not hate mankind, a left that is not fundamentally nihilistic, that is not fundamentally anti-human life. So, wow, I was blown away. There were probably three people on the two panels who I kind of, you know, I disagreed with a lot of what they said, but I kind of respected, because these are people I'd like to debate instead of the people I usually debate, who are pretty pathetic. I'd like to debate some of these kind of, maybe the old line Marxists, I don't know what they are exactly, but they, you know, these modernists who are so anti everything, anti life, anti technology, anti human life, and environmentalists and panicky, and the world is going to end. These guys didn't have that at all. They were all pro growth, post prosperity kind of, people. So I thought it was really, really interesting. And so that's so far in England. Tomorrow I go to one of my favorite universities on the planet. I go to Exeter. Exeter is always fun. They always have a good audience. They always ask good questions. This will be my third time in Exeter. You can find the videos of the first two times. They're some of the best videos I've ever done, both because I was good and also because one of the things that Exeter always does is that the film club films my events, and they do a good job. So it's always HD with multiple cameras, and they do a really good job of the videos. And then tens of thousands of people tend to watch it online. So it really is a fantastic event. So I'll be doing that. I'll be talking about free speech at Exeter tomorrow. And then after that, I will be on Tuesday. Tuesday we have the Ayn Rand Lecture. The Ayn Rand Lecture is an annual lecture held by the Adam Smith Institute. Every year, a different businessman comes to talks who's been influenced by Ayn Rand talks. Last year, we had Ken Molas. The year before that, we had David Sokol. John Allison has spoken there. Lars Christensen has spoken there. And this year, we have a woman. Her name's Julie Mayers. Mayers is an American who has been living in London for a long, long time. She runs the Entrepreneurship Network here, and she's going to talk about the importance of entrepreneurship. So I think that's going to be a very fun event and a very exciting event, and I think she'll do a good job. So that is Tuesday night. That Wednesday, I'm speaking at King College for the Libertarian Group at King's College London. And then Thursday, I fly to Poland, a place where I'm very, very popular. In terms of Facebook followers, I have the most I have from the United States, obviously, by a big margin. Second is Brazil. Third is Poland. So I am more popular in Poland than any other place other than Brazil in the United States of America. So I'm sure we'll have a great turnout in Poland. I'm giving a talk there on the evils of socialism. Then they're holding a debate in Polish, capitalism versus socialism. I'm not participating because they're doing it in Polish. Then I fly on Friday from Warsaw in Poland to Chicago. And on Saturday in Chicago, I'm participating in something called the Freedom Forum. And on the Freedom Forum, I am, I'm doing a talk on inequality and equal is unfair. I'm participating in a panel discussion about the election and about the state of America with some, I think, pretty well-known radio personalities, at least in the Chicago area. and book signing, and I'm doing something else, which I can't remember. And then finally, on Sunday, I fly to California, only to go to work on Monday at the Institute, I'm sure. All right. That is the story of my travel. If you have any questions, if you have any comments, if you have any suggestions, if you want me to come to your country, if I haven't been to your country, you know, drop me an email, ariradio@icloud.com, ariradio@icloud.com. Drop me an email and we can see if on one of my future trips I can arrange to stop by your country and visit with you. That'll be fun. All right, we're going to take a break. I encourage you, by the way, after the break to call in with questions, with open to answering questions about anything. 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. And then I do want to talk about, and we'll see if I have enough mental energy and capacity to do this, but I really want to talk about what I think is the essential, fundamental, core conflict in the world today. And that is the conflict between reason and emotion, or reason and mysticism. And I think this is reflected incredibly in our election right now. And I think it really is reflected in all the debates and the disputes and the challenges and the disagreements that I see around us. They're really the essential issue, the issue of our time, is not only individualism versus collectivism, which we talk about a lot and is clearly at the core of it, but deeper than individualism and collectivism, is the issue of reason versus mysticism. And if you're, you know, and we'll talk about that, why one has to lead to collectivism and the other leads to individualism, and why we have to tackle this head on. And as hard as it is to tackle, we have no choice if we're to win the battle or the war that we are fighting. All right, we'll be right back. Let's see if I can find the right commercials after this break.
Every week on Radical for Capitalism, Yaron Brook discusses news, culture, and politics from the objectivist perspective. But if 1 hour a week just isn't enough for you, the Ayn Rand Institute's e-store has what you need. ARI's e-store is home to hundreds of courses and talks that will not only help you improve your understanding of objectivism, but also help you acquire the intellectual tools that you need to enhance your life. Listen at home, in the car, anywhere, to more talks by Ayn Rand, Yaron Brook, and other leading minds in objectivism, including Leonard Peikoff, Harry Binswanger, Edwin A. Locke, and Peter Schwartz. Shop the e-store today at estore.aynrand.org.
You've heard the endless warnings. Economic inequality is growing and will continue to grow. But the question almost no one asks is, why should we care? It's an important question. Economic inequality has nothing to do with poverty. In some countries, people are relatively equal and extremely poor. In other countries, like the United States, people are relatively unequal, and the vast majority of people are, by world standards, extremely rich. Inequality just means there's a gap between what different people earn, and the gap can grow even if every single individual is becoming better off. And that's really the story of capitalism. Economic progress makes us all better off, just at different rates. So, why should we care about inequality? For more on inequality, see the new book by Yaron Brook and Don Watkins, Equal is Unfair, America's Misguided Fight Against Income Inequality. For more information, go to equalisunfair.com. That's equalisunfair.com.
If you're a teacher looking for compelling and intellectually challenging material for your students, the Ayn Rand Institute's Free Books to Teachers program is for you. This program provides free, yes, free, classroom sets of Ayn Rand's best-selling novels, Atlas Shrugged, The Fountainhead, and Anthem, teachers in the United States and Canada. All you have to do is commit to teaching the novels in your classroom during this academic year. Join the more than 50,000 teachers who have already taken advantage of this unique educational program. To receive your free set of books, visit aynrand.org/freebooks. A free comprehensive teacher's guide will accompany your order. Visit aynrand.org/freebooks today.
If
If you want to learn more about Ayn Rand, her ideas, and their relevance today, subscribe to the Ayn Rand Institute's YouTube channel. It's loaded with hours of material exploring the objectivist perspective on topics ranging from religion versus reason, freedom of speech, and capitalism, to the pursuit of happiness, and much more. New videos are always being added, so subscribe today by visiting youtube.com/AynRandInstitute.
All right, and we're back. All right, so I see nobody's calling. Today you guys are quiet. Okay, let's talk about what I think is, when you look around the world, what the fundamental challenge. If we look just in terms of morality and politics, then it's clear that the fundamental disagreement is individualism versus collectivism, or egoism versus altruism. We are told that one should live for the group. That is essentially collectivism, that the group is the ultimate value, that everything needs to be measured based on the benefits to the group. Nobody ever defines how you do that or what it means or how it's supposed to actually function. Of course, it can't. And this is why it always leads to some kind of authoritarianism, whether it's soft authoritarianism through the mechanisms of modern democracy, or whether it's hard authoritarianism, as it is with dictators and things like that. But what you always get is the collectivism. Somebody has to figure out what the collective wants, and we can ask it. We can have referendums about everything, and some countries do that. Switzerland does that a little bit, and certainly California, the state of California, does that quite a bit. That somehow doesn't satisfy people. It's not good enough, and it almost always reverts to more than that. And of course, referendums are a disaster. And how do you fix it? How do you deal with the consequences, the horrible consequences of decisions made by some people to oppress other people? Because that's always what happens. The majority votes to oppress a minority, and we all know from Ayn Rand that the ultimate minority, or from reality, from facts, that the ultimate minority is the individual. So collectivism always leads to statism. Collectivism always leads to some form of statism, socialism, fascism, or the current kind of mixed economy that we have in the Western world, in the United States. There's just no way around it. At the end of the day, somebody to figure out what the collective wants, and it's always going to be at the expense of the individuals, the individual within society. Individual is not represented in a collectivistic system, because there is no such thing as an individual. The individual doesn't count. The individual doesn't matter. The whole point of collectivism is that it's okay to sacrifice the individual for the collective. And this is exactly, this of course comes from altruism. And altruism is the moral theory that says that your life doesn't belong to you, really. It's not your moral purpose to live your own life for your own sake. But ultimately, the purpose of your life is to serve others, who, some group, always. It's always some group. It's never one individual, although it can be the individual if it's the authoritarian, but only... It's always justified in terms of, even if you're supposed to sacrifice to Hitler or to Stalin, you're sacrificing to him as the representative of the group. But it's always, altruism is always leads to collectivism. So the progression is altruism leads to collectivism, leads to authoritarianism, right? Now let's take the other side of that, the side of egoism. Well, egoists are people who want to live their life based on their values, pursue their goals, and who knows what's good for you? Who knows what your values are? Only you know that. And of course, because of that, individualists, egoists, want to remain free. They want to be able to make choices. They want to be able to decide what is good for them, and therefore, egoism leads to individualism. I am the unit. The group is not the unit. I might associate with a group if there's a benefit for me, but otherwise, other than that, I'm not going to sacrifice to the unit. I don't believe in sacrifice. And therefore, ultimately, that all leads up to freedom, to the individual remaining free so he can pursue his own egoistic ends. But there's something deeper than both of those. There's something deeper that leads one to the view of egoism. And there's something deeper that leads one to the view of altruism and collectivism. And I see this wherever I give talks about morality and people about morality as a rational system to guide man's life towards his own flourishing, towards his own happiness, towards his own success. That morality is a code of value that we can reason, that we can come about rationally. And people just can't get that. It just can't, it can't get through to them. Because to them, morality is a set of commandments. Morality is something that somebody told them what they can and cannot do. And ultimately, that somebody has got to be either God or the Fuhrer or the spirits or some form of mysticism. Because there's no other source for telling you who to sacrifice to and which group is worthy of your sacrifice and what collective is important. Every theory of statism ultimately has at the heart of it some form of mysticism. You know, religion is obvious, Christianity or Judaism, which, you know, they have God and God said X and you're supposed to do X. You're supposed to do X. And it's a commandment-based system. It's a system that basically conditions your mind to follow orders. That's what religion does to you. All religions, Islam, Judaism when taken seriously, and Christianity. Yes, you know, in Judaism, they debate forever every comma in the Bible or in some book that some scholar wrote. But it's not real thinking. It's not dealing with reality. It's not real reason. It is a completely detached, rationalistic system based at the end on mysticism, on faith, the idea that that word in that book has some deep, deep significance above anything in reality, that it's mystical in some way. So religion conditions us to authoritarianism. It conditions us. It prepares us for authoritarianism. And one of the examples Ankar Gatte and I use in a paper we've just written about the fact that religion is incompatible with freedom is the example of Abraham. Right? Abraham, who is considered a moral hero, one of the greatest men to live by Jews, Christians, and Muslims. Why is he considered such a moral hero? Because when God told him, kill his son, he said, okay, I'll do it. He didn't question. He didn't argue. He didn't challenge. He didn't yell. He didn't object. He didn't tell God to go to hell, which is what I would have done. I assume many of you would have done the same thing. Even if God exists, I would have told him to go to hell. He just said, yes, sir. Yes, master, I guess. And did it. And that's why he is considered a moral hero. That it is that kind of submission. It is that kind of acceptance of commandments, of authority, that is essential to Christian and Jewish morality. Now, again, Christians and Jews, differentiate from Christianity and Judaism, have also been impacted by reason and science and by thinking since the Old Testament. But there was a fragment of this idea of authoritarianism, of moral authoritarianism, of epistemological authoritarianism, that you get the truth from a book, you get the truth from revelation, you get the truth from something outside of your own mind. There's an element of that in most people. And this is the great tragedy of the West. The great tragedy of the West is, in my view, basically Christianity is killing the West. It's not killing it overtly, because many people say, but look, Western Europe is secular. it's killing it because it's destroyed our capacity to think. It destroys our capacity to think. It makes it very hard to actually think because it's destroyed the methodology. It denies the methodology of thinking. So yes, religious people can be successful in particular areas, but it's only to the extent that they have rejected religiosity. They've rejected mysticism in that particular area. But you see, the mysticism goes further than just religion, because I would argue that and others have argued, that communism is just an extension, if you will, of Christianity. I think this is Ayn Rand's point. Karl Marx does is secularize Christianity. He takes the altruism of Christianity, and he takes the collectivism of Christianity, and he takes the authoritarianism of essentially of God, and he replaces God with the proletarian. So the proletarian is the source of all truth. You need a leader, which is why you need a communist elite, until one day we are all proletarian and we all have a mind sink, I guess. And the leader's responsibility is to tell you what the proletarian really wants, needs, and to demand from you that you sacrifice for the sake of the proletarian, just like the Pope or religious leaders who can communicate with the spirits, demand from you to sacrifice for the sake of God, a demand for you to sacrifice for the sake of others. So it really is so destructive. And it's why communism is so appealing in I think, a Christian culture. It's because, and why socialism just won't go away. It won't go away. And it won't go away because of the altruism that Christianity embeds in people. But it's also this way of thinking, this acceptance of authority, this willingness to accept central planners who can tell us what's good and bad for us. Because conditioned to the fact that we don't know what's good and bad for us, God will tell us. Or the Pope will tell us, or the priest will tell us, right? Instead of figuring out ourselves, instead of using our minds to do it ourselves. So we'll get to the side of reason in a minute. And the same thing with Hitler, right? What is National Socialism? Remember, the Nazis were National Socialists. What is National Socialism? It's the same thing. It's replacing God with the Aryan race. And of course, the Aryan race doesn't have a voice, so it needs a voice. And that's where, Hitler comes in. He becomes the voice of the Aryan race. You need a Führer in order to give voice to the needs. And he, how does he know what the Aryan race needs? Well, he has some superpower, some ability to commune with the spirit of the Aryan race, not any different than the ability of commune with the spirit of God, or commune with the spirit of the ghosts, or commune with the spirit of whatever it is. And he does it, and he tells you who to sacrifice for. It's exactly the same thing. He tells you who to sacrifice for. And in a smaller way, all of this is true. In a smaller way, all of this is true for every statist out there. They all think that it's okay to sacrifice one group for the sake of another's, raise your taxes for the sake of somebody else. And they're always the ones who make that judgment. They're the ones who know. How do they know? How do they know that giving money to poor black kids and whatever is going to help them in their future? They don't know. Indeed, the scientific evidence all suggests that they're wrong. How do they know that having a huge stimulus package is going to help the economy? There's no scientific evidence of it. There's no economic theory that suggests it. It's a form of the same kind of mysticism. It's a form of placing their wishes above their wills, above facts and above reality. And they always justify it in a bunch of mumbo jumbo. And at the end of the day, it's because they, the experts, the philosopher kings, know best. And think about the population that buys into it. The population that buys into it, again, is being conditioned not to think. It's being conditioned to emote. It's being conditioned to believe. It's being conditioned to follow commandments. And, of course, in our schools, we work hard on this issue of emotionalism. And you know, when we get a bunch of 7-year-olds or 8-year-olds and put them in the circle and ask them what they think of the latest election, they can't think about the latest election. There's no thought that they can have about the latest election. They don't have the context. They don't have the knowledge. They don't have any idea what an election is, not in any kind of meaningful sense. They don't have ideas about political philosophy. They cannot have an idea about the election. And yet we ask them. So what do they tell us? What they feel about the election. And we celebrate that. We celebrate that. We give them ribbons for feelings. So, you know, progressive education has emphasized emotion above all, feelings above all. And what does that leave you? What does that leave you if you have emotions? How do you know what the truth is? How do you know what to do? How do you know how to act? How do you know what's right and what's wrong? You don't. You don't. Because the only tool to know any of those things is human reason. And if you deny reason in the name of emotions, then you have to rely on authority. You have to say, tell me, please, how to do this. Tell me what to do. Right? Guide me. And that's statism. It can be in a severe form as fascism, communism, or it can be in a milder form of just the regular statism that we have today. But when we condition people to follow their emotions, what we're conditioning them also is not to think, not to require evidence, not to require proof. And then how are they supposed to know what's truth? You know, so today at one of these panels in London, this guy goes after comes out for the minimum wage and all this stuff about the minimum wage. And it's like, people, there's a science here. There's a science. You're denying the law of gravity. And the reason you can get away with it is because it's a little bit more complex. It's not really more complex than the law of gravity, but it's because you are putting your emotions before reason. And there's a bunch of authorities, Paul Krugman, Stiglitz, all these other, you know, so-called economists, who have declared, not proved, but declared that raising the minimum wage is okay, or the president or the prime minister, and he was quoting these people, right? And that gives it legitimacy. You're looking at what people are saying, what the so-called experts are saying, instead of the facts of reality. So what you get is because we're emphasizing emotion, and because our culture is already kind of saturated with religion and therefore mysticism, is you're getting more and more and more statism. You're getting many more and more and more altruism, right? Who benefits from the altruism? Well, the powers to be. The people in power get to tell you who to sacrifice to. And of course, they benefit from that sacrifice. Benefit in quotes, right? Benefit in a sick kind of way. Benefit in the sense of gaining more power. Benefit in the sense of gaining more money. Not benefit in the sense of human flourishing. But they benefit. So Hillary Clinton becomes rich even though she's a complete nincompoop, because she has control. And she can use that control to get rich. And she loves the power. She loves power over people. And she loves the money because that gives her more power. Right? So those people want you to be altruistic because they're the beneficiaries of your sacrifices. And they love, I mean, love is the wrong word. They feel good about controlling people, about having authority over them, about telling them what to do. So this authority, right? People desire this authority. And you see it with Donald Trump. People love Donald Trump, not because he's articulated any kind of program, not because he's told people what he's actually going to do, but because he said, make America great and trust me. Trust me. And people are ready to trust somebody who's straight talking, no BS, no nonsense, no political correctness. But Donald Trump exhibits all the characteristics of an authoritarian, and people love it. And people love it exactly because they refuse to think. People love it exactly because they've been conditioned to non-thought. They've been conditioned to emote. They've been conditioned to to mysticism. And they're looking. They're constantly looking. Who will save me? Who will save me? Who's going to be the person who saves America? in that person. How is he going to save America? By communing with some unknown spirit. And he will know what's right. He will know what to do. He will know how it's done. And you see it. You see it in the way people respond to one of the things I find astounding about Trump is that so many of his supporters say they disagree with this and they disagree with this and they disagree with this, but they trust Trump. Based on what? There's zero evidence that Trump is trustworthy, that he will do what he says, that he has any understanding of economics, that he will listen to his advisors, that he has any understanding of the world affairs. What we do know is there's tons of evidence of his thin skin, of the fact that he can't take criticism, that he has to wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and tweet horrible things to people. Trump has no common sense, zero common sense. What he is spouting to people is the emotional platitudes that they want to hear. And they're responding to it because they have become emotionalists, complete emotionalists. And it's, again, it's this mysticism kicking in. It's the mysticism kicking in. And I see it with the alt-right. I see it with the, you know, what is racism? But a form of mysticism, you know. So you've got all these loser white guys, all these losers who are white guys. And they want to take credit for Michelangelo and Beethoven and the founding fathers. Why? Because they were white guys too. It's astounding. It's astounding to me that this in the 21st century, this exists. But this is pure mysticism. This is this idea. It's not an idea. It's a feeling of the, there's some kind of power of the group. There's some kind of significance to the group. There's some kind of meaning to this group. And it happens to be a group based on skin color. And it is truly, truly shocking. The extent to which our political system today is influenced and motivated by these mystical, emotionalistic characteristics. And it's really all over the world, because everywhere, as soon as you get to the issue of altruism, immediately the mysticism rises up. Because I ask people, why should I sacrifice? And there's no answer. This is what Ayn Rand always said. You ask the question, why? And their argument falls apart because there is no answer. The answer is because. And they struggle. What would happen to poor people? And you explain to them what would happen to poor people. But what would happen to these people? When you explain to them that, but what would happen to those people? It's because altruism is so ingrained in them that they can't question, and it's ingrained in them because they are conditioned to accept morality as a commandment. As this is how it must be. There is no other option. By the way, if you want to call in, ask any questions, 347-324-3075, 347-324-3075. All right, we've got a question here. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, this is Jennifer from Michigan.
Hey, Jennifer, how are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm tired.
I know, I can imagine. I just thought of something. Sometimes there are some people, now I understand objectivism very well, I think, but sometimes there are some people, like in the media, I won't name names, but some people that I like, and they're for freedom, and they say they're for freedom. They say they're for capitalism and for freedom, and I think they're good people, but they're also religious too, at least to a certain extent. I'm not talking about Glenn Beck, by the way. I'm talking about some other people.
Okay.
But I know they're religious to a certain extent. They're certainly not atheists. But I think they're good people, though, and I don't think they would, you know, they accept authority or anything. So I assume they're splitting their brains into, like people tend to do, which I don't understand how people can do that.
Compartmentalizing. Yeah, I mean, I think that's some of it. But I think you have to be careful. I mean, look at somebody like Hannity, who is kind of in that thing. He always says he's for freedom, he's for capitalism, he's for this, he's for that.
And not him, I was talking about.
Yeah. And then immediately, as soon as Trump shows up, he becomes a complete, you know, a gaga, unquestioning, you know. But there are a lot of people who are religious and who really do care about freedom. And I think they're compartmentalized. I think what happens with those people is they are primarily people who are motivated by reason, but they can't give up on the emotional tug of religion. So they function through reason most of their life, including their kind of philosophical defense of freedom. But then, you know, they've still got this religion that tugs on them. And of course, when you get to things like abortion and you get to things like gay marriage and other things, then they're really torn because they want to believe in freedom, but they also, you know, they struggle with the fact that their religion prohibits these things. So I feel for these people, but on the other hand, it's a choice they have to make.
I was actually talking about Charles Payne, okay? I'll say it.
Oh, I
like,
yeah, I like
Payne.
He's a
good man. I think he's such a good man.
I agree with
yeah,
him. He's
I
great
really
on Trump.
Think he
he's
is.
Great on the alt-right. And he
right.
off quotes our work because he admires Ayn Rand and he has a lot of respect, I think, for me. And he is a good guy, but I think there's an emotional tug. There's an emotional connection where he just can't give it up. And I think you're right. He completely compartmentalizes.
Yes, I like him a lot. You know, I really, really want to like him, and I do like him. I like him a lot. But then I think, I wish he'd let go of that one part. But I overlook it because I do think he's such a good person.
I do, too, and I think you should. And look, I think there's some people like that who are really good, who really devoted to reason in 90% of their lives or 95 or 99% of their lives. But there's one area in which they've got this religious tug. And at the end of the day, you know, they're good people and they're helping the cause, and their children are more likely to be atheists than they are because they'll raise them well. But I agree with you. I agree with you about Charles Payne, and I agree with you generally about people like that, and there are quite a few of them.
Okay.
Great. Thanks.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Hi. Thanks for listening. Yep.
Okay.
All right. We got one other call here. Let's see. Hi, you're on the Iran Book Show. Who's this?
Hi, my name's Ian.
Hi, Ian. How's it going?
Not too bad, buddy. How are you?
Good, good.
I'm calling you from London, actually. Looking forward to seeing you at the meetup group on Wednesday.
Okay, good. So you're right here.
Okay. I have. I hope this question doesn't push your show off topic. It's a bit of a general question.
Okay.
By way of background, I came to Ayn Rand kind of late. I'm 42 now. Came to Ayn Rand at the age of 30, and up until that point, I guess I was a full-on left-wing nightmare. And I read all of her books and totally agree with pretty much everything. But as a result, I found that I find it very, very hard to relate to, you know, everybody I grew up with, all of my closest friends with whom I had the closest bonding experiences, you know, college and MBA.
Yep. Yep.
99% of all TV shows I watch, I find them dumb and ridiculous, have terrible moral positions. 99% of all political discussions I find completely futile and a complete waste of time because they're just playing rhetorical games and they're not really discussing anything of substance. All of the music I listen to pretty much has left-wing lyrics. All Hollywood movies have altruistic, sacrificial, moralistic tones to them. How does one not be depressed about if you hold an Ayn Rand view that
I like? Yeah, I know. I agree with you. First is to replace the old friendships. So two things. One, think about your values, and you can segregate your values. So you can have friendship with people who don't agree with you on everything if you share certain values. Now, I don't have any childhood friends either, but partially it's objectivism, partially it's probably my character. And I don't have friends who are not objectivists. I can't think. I mean, I do have some. But we're pretty close to objectivism. We're almost objectivist, if they're not completely objectivist. Yeah, I mean, I couldn't tolerate friends who completely disagreed with me on these kind of things. So I find new friends, and friendship is important. You got to find those people. Art is a little bit more complicated. Aesthetics is a little bit more complicated. I can enjoy a lot of kinds of art that have the wrong morality. I for example, admire people who, when they believe something, go all the way on it, even if that means environmentalism, even if that means some really nasty moral code. I can enjoy something like that. So I can enjoy, I mean, I even like paintings of Jesus and things like that because there's certain aspects of the paintings that I can find that I can enjoy. So I have a pretty broad, even the, you know, the songs with leftist music, leftist lyrics, what can you do? I mean, I just shut out the lyrics. And I focus in on the music, which I think is the more important part of the songs anyway. And I listen to a lot of classical music, which doesn't have lyrics, thank God. So But I go, I love to go to opera. I love to see opera, but not because of the content, but because of the passion. They believe in stuff. They're willing to die for stuff. They're willing to fight for stuff. They're in love. And when they're in love, they're hugely passionate about it. So I try to find the good things. And then I avoid politics except when I have to comment on it, because I think politics is stupid generally, and I just try not to watch it and just, you know, ignore it. And to the extent that I can, in my position, I can't really do that. But the point is, I think, is you got to find the values that you care about, and you got to pursue them, and you got to you got to find the good things in your life. And and I think there's a lot of good out there. You know, I still enjoy technology. I enjoy the latest gizmo that comes out. I have friends who are share my values, share my ideas. I get involved in some people get involved in the fight, because fighting the irrationality of the world helps you deal with the irrationality of the world. And I try to find good movies, and I try to recommend good movies and good music and good stuff here on the show to help you guys on the aesthetic stuff. And actually, I saw a really good movie last night, and I'm going to recommend it. I just need to figure out what the name of the movie was, and I will in a few minutes. Anyway, that's the best I can do in terms of advice. It's tough. You know what the toughest thing for me is, and you guys might, I mean, this might sound very arrogant, but I think it's true. What I find really, really frustrating is the fact that I think I can solve all the world's problems, or at least a big chunk of the world's problems, and nobody pays attention to me. Nobody gives a shit.
I think the toughest thing for me is how unopen to reason some people are.
Yep. No, like, I think that's right. You have to walk away from those people. Yeah.
I have one. If you want a small example, I have a chat room group on WhatsApp with old NBA friends, and of course, everyone's slagging off Trump. And I just try for one second to say, okay, I agree, the guy is crazy, and I don't like him. But can we just look at Hillary for a second?
Yep.
And it's just impossible. It's absolutely impossible to raise an issue that she may have questionable economic views, or that she may have lied, or she may be in any way bad. Because immediately they're like, oh, you're just following crazy conspiracist nut job theories, and you know, people are just giving her a bad name, and you can't. It's very depressing how you can't talk to people, and I'm talking about people that are master's degree educated.
No, I think that's right, and I think this is what I was talking about before. Is there's a certain mysticism that is they accept that the right is evil, that the right is wrong, as represented by Trump and others, and then they shut down any critique of the alternative. By the way, there's feedback, I think, because the show is playing in the background on your phone. But anyway,
I switched it off.
Yeah. Thanks for calling. Let me get back to the show and the topic. But you raise a great point. It's kind of depressing. But look, I do think that this is all, at the end of the day, kind of a consequence of mysticism, of people not thinking and not open to facts. They know. How do they know? Because the consequences of knowing something else are unthinkable, and because they've been told, and because they feel it, and because it feels right, and because the right people told them this, i.e. the authorities. And it has every characteristic, all of these, it has every characteristics of mysticism, and all the characteristics of emotionalism and religion. And religion is at the heart of this. And religion is what perpetuates this. And again, this is true of even intelligent, non-religious people. They're still impacted by religion. And, you know, it's astounding how closed-minded so many people are. How unthinking so many people are. And it's exactly that unthinking which is what is driving the modern world. So, and this is true both of Hillary supporters and of Trump supporters. I can't talk to Trump supporters. They don't listen. They don't engage because they're completely blinded by it. right? If you say anything negative about Trump, it's like they become blind and they become mentally blind. The same if you say anything negative about Hillary on the left, they, you know, you can't even talk about it. And it really is whereas we look at things through facts. Give us evidence. What did he say? What are the positions? How does this play out? What is the big picture? What is long term? What is the principle behind this? They don't have that conception. They don't have that conception at all. It is, and you can see it in Trump's rallies, and you can see it to some extent. You can see it in all political rallies, but Trump's rallies in particular. It's just a pure emotionalism and adoration that is involved that has nothing to do with anything specific, related to the issues. And I have analyzed Trump to death. So I'm not going to continue doing that. And giving me, as some people in the chat are doing, a list of all the things Trump has said good things about it is completely unconvincing. That's a pure empiricist, unprincipled way of looking at politics and the world. You have to look at the principles. You have to look at what the person stands for and what the person represents and what the person is likely to do. So the real challenge in the world is how do we overcome this mysticism? And I think at the end of the day, we have to become radical advocates for reason, for science, for thinking. And thinking is hard. Thinking is hard for induction, for inductive truth. And all of that is not easy. All of that is not easy. It's not enough. It's not enough just to talk about politics. It's not enough even to talk about ethics. One has to talk about the evils of mysticism and talk about the value of science and reason. And it shouldn't be hard, but it is. It is because so many people just resist it. And again, we train kids from the beginning. And this is, you know, this whole trigger warnings and all this stuff on campuses is an extension of this. It's an extension of placing morality above everything else. And this is what we have to challenge. As long as morality above everything else, emotions above everything else, as long as people place emotions above everything else, then we are doomed. And we live in a culture more and more and more that is the case. And even people who often on the right side of things, it reminds me of the Tea Party. When I used to talk to the Tea Party, I mean, their connection to liberty, their connection to freedom, their connection to the founding fathers was an emotionalist connection. It was not a principled connection. It was not an ideological connection. It wasn't through understanding. This is why, you know, I think so much of the Tea Party has turned to Trump, because he's a way for them to challenge that, to channel that emotion towards what they hope is political change. You know, unfortunately, they're going to be very disappointed. I mean, there's a lot more to say about this issue. There's a lot to say. You could link it up to Plato. And really, this is, at the end of the day, it's the problem of Plato, and it's the age-old, everlasting battle between Platonic philosophy and the conception of the world of forms that Plato has, and the battle with Aristotle, who is pro reason, pro logic, pro facts, pro reality. And of course, if you're pro reason, pro facts, pro reality, then you're going to be an individualist, because it's your reason. You see the facts. You can prove it. You have logic on your side. It's in your mind. It's not some abstraction. All right. Let me recommend this movie. A while ago, I recommended a TV series called The Night Manager, which I thought was excellent, based on a novel by John le Carré. there seems to be this move to turn John Le Carré's works into TV series and films and so on. And I highly recommend, and I continue to recommend to all of you to watch The Night Manager. Let me know what you think. Let me know if you enjoy it. I certainly enjoyed it, and the people who I know have seen it have enjoyed it. It's just it's a really good kind of good quality James Bond-like movie, which I enjoyed. Well, I saw another John Le Carré turned into movie this time on the plane, you know, on my iPad. So it's selling on iTunes, and I see it's on Amazon. And I think it might even be still in the theaters. It's called Our Kind of Traitor. Our Kind of Traitor. What I like about this and The Night Manager is that both movies about what you would call ordinary people put into extraordinary situations and having to make meaningful moral decisions, decisions that are meaningful to their lives and to put them at great risk, and the courage it takes to take those moral decisions and to take those kind of actions. So, a traitor, what's it called? Our Kind of Traitor. And the fact is that most of the actors were not that well known. Let me see, who do I know here? I don't really know. I mean, Stellan Skarsgård, I think, is a well-known actor, but a lot of the others I just didn't know. But I thought Ewan McGregor is in it, who's well-known, but most of the actors were new to me. But I thought it was excellent. I really enjoyed it. It's not getting a huge rating on IMDb and I guess on other places. But, it's got some plot holes and stuff. But I thought overall, as a portrayal of a good hero and good heroic action, and it was good and interesting and something you don't often see. So to those of you depressed out there, it's once in a while to see a hero on screen is fun, and I thought that movie did a pretty good job of it. I generally like John Le Carré, even though he's got this a lot of his books have a strong moral ambiguity. But let me recommend, it looks like in 2017, next year, we're going to have a TV miniseries based on The Spy Who Came In from the Cold, which I thought was an excellent book. Again, moral ambiguity between the Soviet Union and the West, unfortunately, is often in John Le Carré's books, but the stories are exciting and heroic and good. And he's also, in one of his other books, he was very anti-pharmaceuticals. I think it was The Constant Gardener. So I don't recommend that. But there seems to be now I think his family has taken over his properties and are basically working to make them into a new movies. I also like Smiley's People. I recommend Smiley's People as a what do you call it? Smart thinking man's kind of spy book, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy. So those two, Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy and Smiley's People, they're kind of dark, slow, but very smart, very clever, particularly the ones that were made. I think Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy was in 79 and Smiley's People was in 82. Those were good. I understand they're going to be recreations of those miniseries. Those are two TV series. They were really good, done in the 79 and 82, and I think they're going to remake them here soon in a modern context. So I'm excited to see that. Anyway, that is it for today's show. I hope you enjoyed it. Giving you a little bit of flavor of what's going on in Europe or what's going on in my life, and then hopefully you benefited from the discussion about mysticism and reason. I think probably the most important issue of our time. All right. We will see you all next week. I'm not sure exactly where I'll be broadcasting next week, but if I'm not doing a live show next week, certainly in 2 weeks, we'll do a live show and I'll talk to you all then. And on that day, I'll probably be doing it from home. So I'll be yelling again because I try not to yell in hotel rooms. All right. Talk to you soon. Have a great week. You've been listening to your...